Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. It is Tuesday, September 24th. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Labor unrest. Hotel workers at the Hilton Hawaiian Village Waikiki Beach Resort walked off the job this morning. The union says it is the start of an indefinite strike. Can we talk about sewage? Well, wastewater woes are sending dollar signs soaring. Why Kauai residents need to apply for a $20,000 grant to convert from cesspools to something more environmentally friendly. The deadline is at the end of the week. We drill down on numbers related to cancer rates in search of hidden figures to understand what the real health risks are for Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders. And we mark Hawaiian History Month with a discussion on Indigenous knowledge. Some employees at the Hilton Hawaiian Village Waikiki Beach Resort walked off a job at 5 this morning for what the union is calling an indefinite strike. United Here Local 5 says the labor action is against Hawaii's largest hotel property and the world's largest Hilton resort, spanning 21 acres. This morning we talked to Jaya Sadaya, who is a front desk guest services agent. She lives in Kalihi with her whole family, who she says also work for Hilton and are on the strike line. She has been with the hotel chain for a little more than a year, but has been on the on-call list, so her hours aren't regular.
Well, I'm on call, and I'm the lowest seniority of the front desk of guest agents, so I'm on call, and I work various shifts. So it could be from morning to night to overnight. It could be anything, honestly. I work it. I'm actually fighting for myself. So, you know, Hilton provided us, you know, opportunity to work here at the hotel. So I've been here for over a year. I have been on call since last year, and I've been on call, and it was a great opportunity until they started cutting back shifts. And I was like, okay, I was in this situation where I had to find another part-time job. So I actually got two part-time jobs. So altogether, I have three jobs at the moment. I'm trying to look for a fourth one just to support myself. So I'm mostly fighting for myself because I don't have any shifts at all. You know, they're not giving it to me. At first, it was great. They were able to give me five shifts even though I was on call, but they've just been cutting me back for sure. And of course, the wages and benefits and all that as well.
And so it was an easy decision for you to join the strike line?
Oh, yeah. It was definitely a big yes for me because I'm willing to fight whatever it takes. I'm a fighter.
And so what about your coworkers? You know, because I know there are many workers that have been in the hospitality business for a long time.
Everyone has their own reasons. So my personal reasons is just for staffing. A lot of them are wages and benefits and also retirements. They're not giving us what we want. So everybody has different reasons of why they fight and why they want to go ahead and walk the picket line for sure.
And anything else you can share? You guys are in the front of the property?
We're actually at every entrance of the property. So we're at the lagoon, we're on the beach side, we're on the front side as well where everybody enters in usually. We're at every single entrance surrounding the property. So my mother has been in housekeeping for about 30 years this year. My brother works in culinary for 9 years. My twin sister worked at housekeeping, and now it'll be at me at the front desk. He's been here for 7 years. So, you know, I kind of grew up on here. So Hilton has like some sort of sentimental value to me growing up. So that's one of the reasons I chose this place as well.
That was Jaya Sadaya, Hilton Hawaiian Village employee who joined her family on the picket line this morning. We did reach out to the hotel for comment. To be honest, we had trouble getting through to the front desk. It took several tries, and we are still waiting for a response. The Unite Here Local 5 Union called a three-day strike against several hotels over the recent Labor Day weekend. It included Marriott, Kyoya, and Hyatt, as well as Hilton. The union says no future talks have been scheduled. The last bargaining session was with Hyatt on Thursday of last week.
Support for HPR comes from BAMP Project, presenting Chicago September 27th on Maui and September 29th on Oahu. Tickets available at bampproject.com. Support for HPR comes from the Aloha International Piano Festival, featuring HSO Concertmaster Iggy Jang in Tango Extravaganza this Friday at Orvis Auditorium. More at alohapianofestival.org.
Heads up, Kauai residents, a deadline to apply for a $20,000 cesspool grant is this Friday. It's federal money from the infrastructure bill to help homeowners comply with laws to mandate conversion. Stuart Coleman is the founder of VAI, which stands for Wastewater Alternatives and Innovations, a nonprofit aimed to encourage more environmentally friendly systems. On Kauai, there's been some pushback over the expense of converting, but Coleman says we can't afford to keep kicking the can down the road as construction and the environmental costs just keep rising.
We were the last state in the entire country to ban cesspools by more than three decades. And we have, in a way, kind of the most at stake because we're so heavily dependent on tourism. And all the recent research has showed that wastewater and the pollutants and nutrient loading in these coming from these cesspools and injection wells are killing the reefs. And so we just can't afford on a just bottom line issue to damage our reefs because that's our protection. It's for fisheries. It protects us against storms and surges. And, in Hawaiian culture, it's the most important aspect of nature. The coral polyp is where the kumulipu begins, and so it's part of the creation story for a reason because it's so important to our survival here. And so along with the environmental reasons, there are human health reasons why. And so, there are a lot of illnesses that go unreported and we can't just have raw sewage running into our waterways and our nearshore waters. And so it poses all kinds of economic, environmental and health problems that we really are kind of the last state to deal with and we need to deal with it now.
Yes, and we have a deadline that is looming, which is why we have this state law that mandates this conversion from cesspools.
So the counties were each offered $1 million in forgivable loans from the EPA State Revolving Fund. And it was actually Kauai was the first. They've been working on this for a number of years. Then county council members, Mason Chalk and Luke Edlin, have been just leaders on this, as well as the other county council members, realizing that we need funding to support homeowners. It's very expensive currently to convert these cesspools, although there are much cheaper options that we're working with DOH to try to get them to allow and update the code. So they have, combining 2 years, they have $2 million in a fund. And if you're building extra housing, they're running it through the housing office on Kauai, then you can apply for a $20,000 rebate to cut the cost in half to convert your cesspool. Because if you're going to do any kind of renovation or addition, you have to convert your cesspool before you can get permits to do that. So it was a very clever way of moving this issue forward, showing support and giving funding to people who are doing the right thing and converting their cesspools.
And $20,000, I mean, that's a sizable grant, although some people wish it were more.
Yeah, I think the longer we wait on this issue, Catherine, the more expensive it becomes. If you had done this 10 years ago and if we had been a little more kind of insistent on it being done, it would have been much, much cheaper for homeowners. And so every year we wait, it just goes up. And so we're trying to work with the state, the counties, and the federal government to really emphasize the fact that our homeowners are struggling. They need help with this. And, so we need funding, but we also need financing because we can get a car, whether it's new or used, and do financing, make it relatively affordable. But we can't just go out. No one has that kind of money except, for the wealthier folks to go out and spend that much money on a cesspool conversion. But if there's financing and funding and rebates, it's imminently doable. Everyone can do this and it will enhance the value of their properties. That's one thing I think people don't realize. There's a study at UH and it said those with cesspools and on-site disposal systems, their houses are worth less because anybody who buys them knows that they're going to have to spend this money to convert these cesspools. So it's a very practical level and the real estate, Hawaii Real Estate Association has been really supportive and they understand that this is just something that we all need to do. It improves the environment, improves our health, and, on the bottom line, again, improves our home value.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to bite the bullet. And right now, while there is money on the table, because we don't know how long this program is going to last, right? We've got possibly a change of administration, and will they look at this fund differently?
Yeah, and that's an excellent point because, we're getting intel from DC and sources that are saying, yeah, they're really... Feds are trying to get money out the door to help people. And we have more money being offered from the EPA and USDA and these federal agencies through the bipartisan infrastructure law for water and wastewater that's ever been offered before. And so it would just be foolish for the state not to be applying for this funding and as much of it as we can to help homeowners. And DOH, I think, needs, like, what they need more than anything, and it was the top recommendation of the cesspool conversion working group that met, you know, a bunch of volunteers for 4 years that I was on, is we need to create a cesspool section inside DOH that can really focus on helping financing, applying for federal grants, working with homeowners, introducing new technology and new, you know, updating the wastewater code so that we can bring in more affordable ways of doing this. We've got to be coordinated. We've got to have the governor's office is very supportive of the workforce development that we're doing. And there are a lot of legislators, state legislators that are supportive of this idea because we're creating green new jobs and we're bringing federal money into the state. So it will help the economy. It will help homeowners in ways that we're just not doing right now. And to me, that's not acceptable, putting all the burden on homeowners when we can help them with this process. Now, there's some homeowners that say, oh, yeah, it's not a problem. You know, why do we need to do this? I've had a cesspool for decades. Well, it might not, you know, hurt you directly as much, but if you're downhill of a bunch of cesspools, I can guarantee your groundwater is contaminated and is potentially contaminating like private wells on the Big Island in one area of Hawaii Paradise Park. 50% of the private wells sampled had fecal indicator bacteria in them because there's so many cesspools in that area. So that's not something you ever, ever want to contaminate your drinking water supply or your nearshore waters.
And so on Kauai, then, the window is narrowing for the residents there to apply for this, you know, the end of this week, actually.
Yeah. You know, the good news is that this is a pilot project. And what we hope is the EPA has offered $1 million in forgivable loans, and that could go up. If we make this program successful, that could go up yearly. And so we're trying to create a model on Kauai that can be replicated in each county so that everybody has access to this. And again, we're just accessing more of that federal money to help people. And, you know, one thing is we need to start with kind of, you know, a small cesspool fee for homeowners that goes into a special fund to help those same homeowners with the cost of conversion, because we've got to normalize everybody in civilized society across the country and around the world. You pay for clean drinking water, you also have to pay to treat it. It's just a common sense thing. You can't just, you know, why do people with cesspools not have to pay when everybody else does, either improving their system or joining sewer fees? So the goal is to create decentralized sewer systems in rural areas that bring down the cost, establish monthly sewer fees, and then everybody's on equal footing. And you support the people at the lowest levels who can't afford the sewer fee. And so it improves all of Hawaii, our water supply, our coastal waters, our health, and our image globally as a, you know, such an amazing tourist destination. And you help it for the locals, more importantly. The silver lining in all this, along with the federal funding that we can access to help Hawaii's homeowners, is that there are going to be hundreds, if not up to a couple of thousand new jobs that are needed in the state. And these are green jobs that pay well, and they don't have the boom and bust cycles of tourism or construction. And so there's going to be an economic infusion in the state. And so the good news is that we've been able to work to bring in federal funding for workforce development. So 2 years ago, thanks to Senator Hirono's office, we got a grant from the Department of Labor to start our Work for Water training program. And it was so successful that we've already graduated over 100 people that we just were selected, that we got awarded an EPA grant for workforce development to expand that program across the state and create apprenticeships. So this is, if you know young people that are looking for good paying jobs and a way to protect water quality, you know, because that's our most important thing. Water is life in Hawaii, and the Hawaiians knew that better than anyone. And so, you know, if we can steer more people to this industry, there are going to be a lot of openings, and we're going to be rolling out the new courses early next year. So that's exciting.
That was Stuart Coleman of Wastewater Alternatives and Innovations. The group meets this afternoon and Thursday to address solutions to the looming deadlines and rising costs of converting from cesspools to something more environmentally safe. A featured speaker this afternoon will be Maui's Archie Kalepa, who will talk about a pilot project to reuse treated wastewater for irrigation and fire mitigation. So relevant following the recent deadly Maui wildfires. Head to our website. We will have links to the Zoom meeting, which starts at 2 p.m. today.
Support for HPR comes from TS Restaurants and its Legacy of Aloha Foundation, supporting the Maui community and assisting those affected by the wildfires. More about how to help by searching tsrestaurants.com Legacy of Aloha. Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, recognizing September as Suicide Prevention Month. Learn more about risk factors, warning signs, and how to help at afsp.org.
You know, it's been a little more than 2.5 decades since the federal government broke out Pacific Islanders and Native Hawaiians as a separate group from Asian Americans. In the field of medicine, it has thrown the light on hidden figures that have masked health disparities and outcomes of a key cross-section of our population. Skin cancer or melanoma is one area that at first glance tells a different story than what you may believe. Ryan Chantel and Kaeo Kikumanu both have a family history of cancer. They've been involved in a study that was recently published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Network Open. Chantel starts us off.
I'm originally from Kohala on the Big Island, so very, very, very rural community. And growing up, my younger brother was diagnosed with what is called Gorlin syndrome. So it's a cancer syndrome that predisposes those individuals to developing tons and tons of basal cell carcinomas on their skin. It also puts them at higher risk for things like prostate cancer. So watching him over time and the difficulties he had was one of the big early sparks for myself to want to pursue medicine. My grandma's been fighting breast cancer for decades. I've had aunties with cancer. Great-grandfather had stomach cancer, which he passed away from. My grandfather had melanoma. There's tons of cancer. It's so prevalent in our populations here. It's something that really I plan to dedicate the rest of my working years to studying and help fighting.
And Kyle, you had a similar experience, right? Many of your tutus came down with cancer?
Yeah, I had a similar experience. But I think for me, in my generation, there were a lot of family members who already passed from cancer, especially my Hawaiian family members. And so I didn't have the chance to meet them or learn from them because it was too late.
And so the focus today, I think, is melanoma and the high rates and the mortality rates in the population of Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders. So what got you, into this, looking at these numbers and drilling down?
Well, so really what it comes down to is focusing on data disaggregation. What I mean by that is disaggregating data for Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander patients and Asian patients. So historically, this goes all the way back to 1977. During the Civil Rights Movement, they had come to the conclusion that as these populations were growing, we needed to have a set racial group to be able to report on data for them. Unfortunately, even back in the 1970s, it was already known and people were already speaking out about these huge disparities in healthcare and socioeconomics and education. And this came to a head in 1997. Senator Daniel Kaka was one of the big proponents for really pushing to disaggregate Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander patients. And in his arguments, he cited that as a people, Native Hawaiian Pacific Islanders, we just have such high prevalence and mortality from diabetes, from obesity, from kidney disease, from cardiovascular disease, from cancer. And they pushed and they were successful in disaggregating the NHPI and Asian groups. However, there's been a very, very slow uptake of these federally mandated guidelines for identifying these racial groups. And as a consequence, there's a lot of literature out there that just hides the health disparities that Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders face. And it's becoming a big mission of a lot of folks. So like Dr. Keikua Taparo, who was the leader of our lab, Kael, myself, Dr. Kaholukula, Jabsum, Calvin Chong over at UCLA. It's become a huge part of a lot of people's missions.
Right. They're saying there's something else that's going on here, right? I mean, because you would think with skin cancer, melanoma, that folks, you know, who have fair skin, that there would be, you know, higher rates. And that for all of us who are, you know, people of color, you'd think, well, maybe not so. But that's not what the numbers have shown. So talk about that, Kayo.
So we kind of looked at that in our most recent study that was just published. What we found specifically for the melanoma you're talking about was that American Indian or Alaska Native, Black, and Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islanders had a significantly higher risk of death for several cancers across all of the subsites we looked at. But for Black and Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islanders, specifically, there was a higher risk of death for a melanoma, as well as a late stage diagnosis. And so we kind of were interested by that because both racial groups have more darker skin, and melanoma, people may think, does not really affect those with darker skin as much as those with fairer skin. And so we were trying to look into more why was this, because there may be some biases with physicians in treating and diagnosing those with darker skin with melanoma, and also maybe just harder to detect. And so that's one of the source of possibly the inequity in cancer care.
And then Ryan, you had mentioned that some of these cancer cells aren't so readily available. Let's see, with folks with fair skin, it might be on their face or their arm or their leg, where people of color, maybe not so apparent.
Yes, so for melanomas, the incidence is much higher in white patients just because they aren't as protected because of the lower levels of melanin in their skin. However, when white patients get melanomas, they tend to get them in very obvious areas, like they'll get them on their face, they'll get them on their forearms, anywhere that's sun exposed. On the other hand, for darker skin patients, they tend to get subtypes of melanoma that are in places you wouldn't expect, and they tend to be much more aggressive subtypes of melanomas. The most famous example is with Bob Marley, who had an acralectigenous melanoma in his big toe on his right foot. So he had a mark on his big toe, and he had attributed it to him playing soccer.
However,
exactly. But it turned out it was a melanoma, and by the time it was fully addressed, it was too late, had spread to his brain, and ultimately he passed away from that melanoma.
Yeah, so it's in places like your nails or what, in your mouth?
In your mouth.
It's places that maybe, yeah, you wouldn't really think to check. So what struck you as you were going through the data and drilling down?
One of the things, in addition to this finding around melanoma, was going back again to the aggregation with Asian American and Pacific Islanders. And we saw that once again in this study, we weren't specifically looking for it, but we saw that there were differences in health outcomes and cancer care for Asian Americans and Native Hawaiians and other Pacific Islanders, where Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islanders had a significantly high risk of death across all the subsites that we looked at, specifically melanoma, lymphoma, colon or rectum, and cervical cancer. Whereas we found that actually Asian Americans had a lower risk of death for cancers, specifically breast and lung cancer. And we're saying this all in comparison to a white reference group. So when we saw this, it just further reaffirmed the idea that, yes, we need to look at these two groups differently because they do have different health outcomes.
So now that you've looked at the data closely, what's the next step?
So one thing I really want to impress on the audience is that for this particular study, we looked at adolescent and young adult patients. So these are patients with cancer from the age of 15 to 49. And for a lot of these cancers, if you catch them early enough and if you treat them effectively, it's curative. So if this is a 20-year-old with a melanoma that could have had it resected, was cured of that cancer, he has 60 years ahead of him. But if we're not catching it and we're not treating it, then he dies at 25. So a part of what needs to be done is to get the message across that these are cancers that are affecting our population and that the mortality is very high for these cancers. So for our peoples to be cognizant of these cancers, to screen themselves for these cancers. And if they have something that is worrisome, to make sure their physician follows up on it.
Okay, so you really have to be more aggressive about your own health and know that you could be at risk?
I'm definitely interested in this area and something I'm really passionate about, especially in terms of Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islander health, because we've often been overlooked in studies or just not looked at all or included. And I think another thing that we kind of called for in the paper in terms of addressing these issues of racial disparities and how do we just achieve cancer equity or health equity in general, is that we called for racially concordant care, which is basically having physicians look like the people that they're treating, the communities that they're treating. And specifically for this case, for Indigenous populations, that means expanding Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islander and American Indian or Alaska Native physicians in the healthcare workforce. And that would come with having a better understanding of culturally competent care in the clinic as well.
That was Kaeo Kekumano and Ryan Chantel talking about their deep dive into data from the Hawaii Cancer Center and the Hawaii Tumor Registry. Chantel is a second-year medical student at UH, and Kekumano, who just graduated from Harvard, is in the process of applying to the UH Johnny Burns School of Medicine.
Support for HPR comes from Kennedy Theatre presenting Puana, an exploration of the connections that Kanaka Maoli have with their kupuna through song, opening this Friday. Tickets by searching UHM Kennedy Theatre. Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, committed to the people of Hawaii, working to help keep workplaces safe and protect employees' rights. More by searching HIOSH.
You know, September is Hawaiian History Month, but sometimes it's not all about making historical events or remembering historical figures. For the University of Hawaii's Hawaii Nui Akea School of Hawaiian Knowledge, it is also revisiting Indigenous knowledge and understanding how it can apply to modern life. The conversations Russell Subiano spoke with Kumujan Osorio, the dean of Hawaii Nui Akea, about the school's goal to become one of the leaders in Indigenous education.
I do think that there is a need for a real revolution in thinking about how we live on the earth. And that revolution, I think, can be, if not directed, influenced, certainly, by a better knowledge of how our ancestors lived. We lived differently. We thought differently about resources and about the world around us for thousands, tens of thousands of years. I'm not just talking about Hawaiians now, but I'm talking about humanity itself. And it's really been a relatively short period of time that we have taken a different kind of path in terms of economies. And while they have certainly contributed to a great rise in human populations, those things have come at a definite cost. So I'm not so certain that what we're looking at is a gradual kind of accommodation of Native knowledge. I think that there needs to be a stronger push by our own Indigenous communities to be heard and to be allowed to increase our practices, because so many of them are fundamentally friendly to the environment.
I know that the University of Hawaii was established in 1907, and I know that Hawaii Nui Akea was founded about 100 years later. And now I'm reading that UH is striving to become the leader in Indigenous education. Why has the school made that a goal?
One of the people who was very influential in moving these ideas forward, well, there were several people, Haunani K. Trask in the 1980s and 1990s, Lili Kalakame Lehiva. As a professor, she created several really important institutions within the university that predated the creation of the school of Hawaiian knowledge, coming out of the Center for Hawaiian Studies. And then you have the whole wing of Hawaiian linguists and Hawaiian language speakers who have been really responsible for, you know, ending the decline in Hawaiian language speakers and making the language live again in the schools, in public, in the community, but in particular in the arts, right? The amazing plays that have been written and acted at Kennedy Theater, Lai Kawai'i, Awa'ia, and now there's going to be another one this weekend, Puana. There's just been this explosion in creativity in our own language. So all of those things have been nascent kinds of movements, and we have actually pushed against the university so many times. The university was seen as resistant to this expansion of our knowledge and our presence on the campus. And I say that not to criticize the current administration, but just to say that this has been a struggle that our people took onto our own shoulders. This has been a wamo, a burden that we carried. And while the university has opened up to the, I think, the inevitability of this, they've also seen, the university has also seen the advantages of branding itself as a Native Hawaiian place of learning. They see that it makes the university a more attractive place. The administration, I think, also sees what it is actually like to work with Kanaka Maoli, with Hawaiians, on issues that affect and in some cases afflict other universities. So this has been, you know, what is to be done about climate change? Hawaiians and Hawaiian knowledge has some of the answers to this. How do you be resilient in the face of actual physical changes that we know are coming? Hawaiians have some of the answers to this. But, you know, even in terms of how we deal with one another when we disagree, when we are in opposing camps, including serious disagreements on this and other campuses over what is happening in the Middle East. I think that Hawaiians are often called on to talk about how we can debate, argue, and influence events without tearing each other apart.
When you talk about indigenous knowledge, I know that you're very careful to say that Hawaiians have some of the knowledge, which leads me to wonder, is there other indigenous people out there that have the other parts of the knowledge? Do you feel like there's still plenty for Hawaiians to learn from, say, Maori or indigenous culture in Europe or different parts of the world?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because Hawaii Nui Akea is about to host the annual general meeting of the World Indigenous Nations Higher Education Consortium. It's called WINHEC, and everyone in our school knows what WINHEC is. We've just gone through a 10-year accreditation process. The first one was obtained by my predecessor, Maynette Benham. She had the school join WINHEC and then secured its first 10-year accreditation in 2013. And we went through our own process past 2 years, and we have been granted another 10-year accreditation, which I think speaks really highly of the faculty and staff that we have in the school. And I'm saying all of these things as a precursor to this. Indigenous knowledge is growing everywhere in the world. And what it's rising up out of are tribes and nations that have gone through really similar kinds of incredibly oppressive and suppressive events over the course of their history in the last 500 years, 500, now 600 years. The similarities of suppression of language, of religion, of thoughts, of sense of history, of dignity, those things are common throughout the world. And the rise of our people out of that kind of suppression to create educational opportunities that don't simply try to figure out how we can gain entry into, you know, that Western system, how we can be accepted as equals, but actually to create different systems of teaching and research, looking at different priorities that come from our own experience and from our own memories. That is also a global thing.
That was Kumujan Osorio, Dean of Hawaii Nui Akea School of Hawaiian Knowledge at University of Hawaii. He was talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. We'll have a link to information about the public portion of that upcoming World Indigenous Higher Education Conference on Oahu on our website. And that is it for our show today. I'm Catherine Cruz.